to Anomalous Waves, a podcast discussing all things strange. I'm John.
I'm Mommy. And this is Lilliput.
And today I will be talking about phantom cats, also known as ABC or alien big cats.
And I will be discussing Harbingers of Doom.
And we have another spooky movie review, this time the 1980 film Fade to Black.
In spooky news, we will cover the stories of a creepy forgotten island full of human remains and the new real estate listing of Lizzie Borden's home.
Don't forget to check our show notes for all references for today's episode and, of course, all of our contact and social media.
If you have any stories that you want to share with us, be sure to shoot us an email at anomalouswaves@gmail.com or contact us on any of our social medias. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Anomalous Waves.
Phantom cats, also known as alien big cats, are usually described like black panthers. In the documentary Return to Wildcat Mountain, which we all three watched last week, was put out by Linda Godfrey and her son Nathan Godfrey. Now, Linda is the journalist who covered Beast of Bray Road, which we talked about a bit in episode 4. So the documentary talks of many sightings in Wisconsin. There are tons of interviews with witnesses and the similarities of their descriptions with these big black cats. Stephen J. Stanek, a journalist in Hillsboro, Wisconsin, featured in the documentary, has published roughly 150 sightings of these black cats in the last 30 years.
Wow.
He stated that over 50% of the sightings of these big cats were black. He also states that many people incorrectly use the word panther and that there's really no such thing as a black panther.
Yeah, that's true. I forgot about that.
It's either a leopard or a jaguar.
Mm-hmm.
And leopards still have spots, which are called rosettes. So even when they're black, you can kind of see them.
Mm-hmm.
For our purposes, I'll probably say black panther sometimes.
Yeah.
But just know, there's no such thing.
We already addressed it.
So in the documentary, many of the witnesses all described pretty much the same thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
They said that they were about 3 to 4 feet in length, roughly 3 feet tall, usually all black. Some reported yellow eyes, and pretty much everyone, right, said a long, thick tail.
Yeah.
That was as long as the body.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes curled up. So the documentary also uncovers the issues with people reporting these sightings to the Department of Natural Resources, or DNR, and then brushing it off as if they just didn't see a big black cat, but something else entirely.
Yeah.
According to a news statement by Wisconsin DNR, large carnivore specialist Scott Walter, there has never been a documented melanistic wild black panther in the U.S. As we know, many of these witnesses are people from very rural areas.
Yeah.
They're familiar with the area.
Mm-hmm.
They're hunters, farmers, cattle ranchers. They know the land.
They've been out there for generations.
They know the animals. But despite this fact, DNR still insists that they don't know what they're seeing.
I think the most interesting thing to me was they also mentioned that Laura Ingalls Wilder from, as we know her, Little House on the Prairie, in one of her stories she wrote about the Black Panther. Mm-hmm. I think they said it attacked, I think it was her grandfather's horse when he was coming back from town.
Yeah, I think she was telling her grandfather's story.
Yeah, that was it. That was probably the weirdest part for me.
It attacked him on its horse.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Very cool. So Stephen, the journalist, says that he thinks the DNR knows they exist.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to be responsible for the deaths of people's livestock, and they don't want to have to give up timberland to these cats who would be considered endangered species.
Yeah.
So many of the sightings, similar to dogmen and other cryptids, are spotted bounding across the road.
We love roads.
So there are also accounts of this thing roaring at people. One of the stories that Stephen J. Stanick tells is of this kid running in to the house and saying he saw this black leopard, is what he said.
Mm-hmm.
And his dog was chasing it. When they went outside, the black cat turned around and was chasing the dog.
Yeah.
And it roared. And Stephen says that there's only one big cat native to the Western Hemisphere that roars, and that's a jaguar. Here's a clip of a jaguar. So that documentary is all about Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
But there are also tons of sightings in Kentucky. And there's a podcast all about strange things in Kentucky. This is called the Pennyroyal Podcast. And they also have a Patreon group called the Liminal Lodge, where people can share their research. And, you know, they have a live stream every Monday where they talk about new topics that they've been researching. And a couple weeks ago, the topic was these alien big cat sightings all around Kentucky.
Wow.
So the stream was with Nathan Paul Isaac, who's the host of Pennyroyal Podcast, Kyle Cadell, who is a contributor to the podcast, and he also owns the International Paranormal Museum and Research Center in Somerset, Kentucky. And for Hellier fans, they'll know that in season two, they interview both Kyle and Nathan.
Mm-hmm.
And also Darian West, who is a contributor to the Pennyroyal Podcast as well. So all three of them agree that these alien big cat sightings are the most reported cryptid, at least in Kentucky, and that they've heard like at least over like 100 reports. So in Kentucky, they also call them painters instead of panthers.
I love that.
So I'll play a couple clips of people describing their big black cat encounters in Kentucky.
Let's hear it.
So this was when I was really small, like, but where, like, my parents got divorced when I was 5 and I had such a traumatic experience, I really cling on to those times that my mom and dad were actually together. And so memories, like, stick with me all the time. And we were driving out. This was, like, not too long after 914 bypass was built on this side and was still new. And we was in a Jeep, and we was going out. We lived on Rose Road at the time, which is right below it there. And where the cliffs go, we was in the Jeep, and I remember this big cat, like huge cat, black as night, jumping down from one of the cliffs there, like not where it's too high, you know, but probably like 10 foot, jumped down, like came in front of the headlights, you know, like that. And then my dad slams on the brakes, and I remember I'm in a booster seat, and it's got like green foam on it and gray, and I grab it like this, and I'm in the center of the Jeep and can see it just straight in front of me there, and it just takes off to the left down to Poquet Holler.
Yeah, like I said, I have a friend that his father told me the story and swore on my life, and I've known since I was a kid that he shot one directly in the face and never found it.
Really?
Yeah, it was near a shed at their house. And yeah, he said he shot it right in the face and went to find the body, and it was never there, you know. And I know that, you know, Nathan talked about how they might be linked to, you know, a different, like, they weren't there to begin with, you know what I'm saying?
Right, like they're a sign like of paranormal the window kind of, area.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, 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 yeah. And, it, you know, it kind of makes sense here.
So, yeah. Definitely check out the Pennyroyal Podcast. I will put a link to that in the show notes, as well as a link to the Liminal Lodge, which is their Patreon group. Okay, so one of the first things they talk about is the Beast of Exmoor. Now, these sightings occur in places like Wisconsin, Kentucky, South Carolina, Michigan, but they also occur in places like England.
Really?
So England is part of Great Britain, and Great Britain is an island. Nathan says geographically does not fit the type of environment for these big black cats to naturally live in.
Yeah, I totally remember reading about this one time when I was in high school. I took a class where we honestly never did anything. We all got A's. So we would just sit on the computers and just look up fun stuff. And we found this site that talked about this and mentioned it. There was even like a very grainy photo of what looked like a black panther in the middle of the country in England somewhere.
There you go. You also said a key word that they brought up is that they say there is video and film of this, always grainy. So the Beast of Exmoor was this big black cat that was sighted all around in the 70s and 80s. And I also found an article in Strange Days Zine Volume 5, which is an awesome little zine. It started right after COVID kind of hit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great. I will link the Etsy shop. So here is a piece from that article. So in the 70s and 80s, one cat in particular built up such a reputation that it became known as the Beast of Exmoor. In 1983, a South Milton farmer claimed that the beast was responsible for over 100 dead sheep over the course of 3 months, all of them having died from violent throat injuries. Eyewitness accounts of the Beast of Exmoor describe it as a large black/gray puma or panther-like cat. It's been recorded as being between 3 and 4.5 feet long and 2.5 feet tall at the shoulders. It's been seen leaping over 6-foot-tall fences with ease. In response to the uptick in livestock deaths at the hand of the beast in the 80s, the Ministry of Agriculture called in the Royal Marines in an attempt to eliminate the cat. Snipers were posted in the Exmoor Hills, where they waited for it to reveal itself. Several Marines claimed to have caught a glimpse of the beast fleetingly, but said there was never a safe opportunity to take a shot. A commanding officer on site was quoted as saying that their quarry behaved with high, almost human intelligence, and always moved with surrounding cover amongst hedges and woods. The Marines' eventual departure seemed to lead to an increase in livestock deaths. So 100 sheep in 3 months.
Yeah.
And all these Royal Marines could see it for a second, but couldn't even catch it. So that's how elusive these critters are.
Yeah.
We got some of the descriptions. Now let's go into some of the theories of what these big black cats are.
Let's do it.
These are flesh and blood creatures that just live in these places.
Mm-hmm.
I came across an article in the Marshfield News Herald, which is from Wisconsin. And this was printed on Tuesday, August 9th, 1988. The article is about a man named John Castle and his 35-year research on these black cat sightings. He's mainly been researching reports from Wisconsin, Michigan, and Arkansas. He says, "My main effort is trying to establish that these animals do exist." John Castle also believes there's a possibility that servicemen may have brought them back to this country, stating that most of these leopard types are from Asia and Africa. The article also says that some people think it's possible that these big cats are either in the cougar or jaguar family, but Castle thinks they are leopards. He says if they were in the jaguar family, they would be vicious and attack people. So we got Steven saying, no, these are jaguars. This guy saying, no, these are leopards.
Yeah.
Castle also states that many wildlife authorities consider these reports in the same category as they do UFOs or sea monsters. But he has recorded numerous sightings which cannot be dismissed as mistaken identity or the result of an overactive imagination. These large cats have been observed by college professors, seasoned foresters, outdoorsmen, and citizens who are unquestionably honest and reliable. So in Return to Wildcat Mountain, the documentary, Jeff Kozlowski, owner of Wisconsin Big Cat Rescue, brings up the possibility of a big cat escaping. If you remember, he talks about human air.
Mm-hmm.
He says when it comes to feeding these big cats, cleaning the cages, you have to move them from cage to cage and something could happen somewhere. And that at his big cat rescue, he has what is called a lie liger. That's a male lion mating with a female liger. Supposedly, offspring of a lion and a tiger or a liger are supposed to be sterile, but that's obviously not true.
Yeah.
He has the proof. He says, if something like a jaguar or a leopard escaped from a zoo or one of these sanctuaries, that it might have mated with another big cat in that area, like a cougar or a mountain lion or something. And then its offsprings were big black cats. Possible.
Possible. And also, I didn't know ligers were an actual thing.
Oh, I yes, just, they are.
Yeah.
It's not Napoleon Dynamite's invention.
I know, that's when I...
So it is possible. He says it is possible, you know, with ligers as proof that these big cats can mix.
There are not a lot of cases of cougars attacking people. It's actually pretty rare. A cougar has to be either starving or it's sickly.
So back to the live stream with the Liminal Lodge. Nathan says that technically there are zero melanistic large black cats that have been found north of Mexico in like the last 100 years. He mentions that there are large cats like minks that have darker colors and that that's sometimes used as an explanation.
Oh.
Darian West mentions that in the 20s and 30s, there are these big closed game hunting spaces where people would pay to hunt exotic animals. And that this happened, and the example he gives is Russian wild boars. That's what they used to do, and now Russian wild boars are all over there. And they're an invasive species.
I didn't know about that.
And that his father told him they also used to hunt big cats there.
Really?
So there's another possible escape. So something that's funny, he also mentions that like half of these Black Panther type sightings, the big cat jumps on the hood of the car.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so people see it, you know, straight ahead. But he mentions they're on the hood of the car, not in front of the headlights. So if it's at night and on the road and it's up on the hood of the car, it's going to look black.
True.
No matter what. Yeah. Kyle Cadell, he kind of brings some of the statistics. He says that only 11% of leopards are melanistic, but you can still see the rosettes, the spots.
Mm-hmm.
They're harder to see, but you can still see them. So they're very rare. Across North America, there's been 12 cases ever of a melanistic black bobcat. So
really?
They're just super rare. Now let's go into the stranger side.
Okay.
So first off, the archetype of black jaguars, the symbolism of black jaguars. The Aztecs, Mayans, and Inca all built temples dedicated to the jaguar.
Mm-hmm.
And in Mayan mythology, the jaguar was seen as one of the rulers of Xibalba, the Mayan underworld.
Ooh.
Now, if you read about this, I just read a little bit. It's very scary. So this info comes from Ekbalam, a Mayan god represented by the black jaguar. This is an article by the Yucatan Times. It says, for the Mayan shaman, a black jaguar announced catastrophe or disaster and is associated with the omen and foreknowledge of things to come. It also says that the Roman god Bacchus, which is like the Greek Dionysus, was supposedly nursed by panthers, and in some depictions, he is riding a chariot pulled by the large cats. Bacchus is often thought of as the god of wine and mirth, but he is strongly linked to the unleashing of desires, kind of like Pan.
Mm-hmm.
Both Aztecs and Mayans talked of the power of becoming half jaguar and half human, and that getting rid of your inhibitions can let you act upon your hidden desires. So this reminds me of our Shapeshifters episode.
Yeah.
They had to take their clothes off in the woods and roll around.
Yeah.
And get all wild. And then they could have these superpowers.
Mm-hmm.
So that brings us to Shapeshifters. Even in True Blood, there's werepanthers, right?
Yes,
and it's
there
in Louisiana.
Is. Yep.
So this is from Shapeshifters by Nick Redfern. So this is Chapter 8, The Black Cat Phenomenon. I'm going to read one of the stories from that. It's in Exeter, England, and he was a retired fireman who counted a strange creature in 1978. According to James, on the day in question, he was out walking with his spaniel dog, Sammy, on the Howden Hills, which provide an expansive view of the area, including the nearby city of Exeter. As James and Sammy took a pleasant walk through the hills, they found themselves confronted by a very strange animal. It was Sammy who alerted James to the fact that something weird was about to go down. As the pair took their daily stroll, Sammy suddenly came to a complete halt and began to growl. It was clear that she had picked up on something strange. At first, James thought that perhaps she had picked up on the scent of a rabbit or a fox, although, as James admitted, Sammy had not reacted like that before when rabbits were around. In seconds, the cause of Sammy's behavior became apparent. Around 50 or 60 feet away, a large black animal rose out of the deep grass. At first, James assumed it was a black Labrador. It was not. In mere seconds, James realized what was walking toward him and his faithful pet was a large black cat that resembled a mountain lion. Sammy whimpered and James' heart thumped. When the animal reached a point around 20 feet from the terrified pair, something that provoked even more terror, the huge cat rose up onto its back legs. They were legs that appeared to physically change as it transformed from a four-legged animal to a bipedal one. But that was not the weirdest part of the story. As James looked on, pretty much frozen to the spot with fear, the face of the cat began to change and took on a malevolent, human-like appearance. A strange and sinister grin dominated the face. As the beast did nothing more than stand and stare at James and Sammy, James told me it was the terrible grin that finally made him realize that it was time to leave, as in immediately. As Sammy was only 4 months old at the time, it was easy for James to scoop her up under his arm and get the hell off the hills. He looked back twice. On the first occasion, the cat human was standing, just as it had been 30 seconds or so earlier. On the second look, however, it was gone. So yeah, shapeshifting too.
Yeah.
That's like double shapeshifting.
Yeah.
During the Liminal Lodge live stream, Nathan also talks about the fact that many of these black cat sightings are in the same places as UFO sightings, as Bigfoot sightings, and even black dog sightings.
Oh.
So I kind of found little things about alien big cats in both volumes of Where the Footprints End. So this is from volume 2. The aforementioned propensity for alien black cats to appear at close temporal and geographical proximity to Bigfoot sightings, coupled with the frequency with which creatures of myth and legend shapeshifted into panthers, begs the question of whether or not these are actual felines being observed. And in the early 1970s, future researcher Barton Nunnally experienced his first anomalous sighting. A large, slender, sleek-looking, solid black panther crossing the road. This event kick-started Bigfoot and UFO activity around his Kentucky farm, including vocalizations, footprints, and further sightings. So, whether you believe these are flesh-and-blood creatures, guardians of the borderlands between worlds, or just something else entirely, the phenomenon continues to be witnessed by thousands of people.
So many people know about Mothman. It is a creature that some believe is a harbinger of doom. Mothman was most famously seen in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, before the Silver Bridge collapse on December 15, 1967. Mothman is said to have started to appear in Point Pleasant a year before the bridge disaster took place. In mid-November of 1966, two Point Pleasant couples said they encountered a man-sized bird-like gray creature whose eyes glowed red when the car's headlights picked it up while they were in an area called TNT at about midnight. Now, the TNT area was the site of a former World War II munitions plant. Sheriff's deputies and city police went to the scene at about 2 o'clock in the morning, but were unable to spot anything. Steve Mallett and Roger Scurberry described the thing as being 6 or 7 feet tall, having a wingspan of 10 feet and red eyes about 2 inches in diameter and 6 inches apart. It was like a man with wings, Mallett said. It wasn't like anything you'd see on TV or in a monster movie. The men and their wives were in Scarberry's car between 11:30 p.m. and midnight when they spotted the creature near the old power plant, adjacent to the old National Guard Armory buildings. Sightings of what area newspapers dubbed the Mothman continued throughout the next year, and the sightings often left witnesses with a deep feeling of dread. Mothman sightings came to a stop in December of 1967 after the Silver Bridge, which carried U.S. Route 35 over the Ohio River, collapsed under the weight of heavy rush hour traffic, killing 46 people. Mothman sightings are pretty rare in the area now, but photos of a Mothman-like creature was taken by a man driving through Point Pleasant, and it made headlines in 2016. So Mothman got me thinking about other so-called harbingers of doom. And it turns out there is quite a few out there.
Very cool.
So the first one I'm discussing, I have to admit, I just thought it was something from SpongeBob SquarePants. The Flying Dutchman is a doomed vessel whose sea captain was said to have gone mad. He was fighting to get around the Cape of Good Hope during a ferocious storm, and he swore that he would succeed if he had to sail until Judgment Day. Well, the devil heard his oath, and he took him up on it. The Dutchman and his crew were then doomed to an eternity of sailing the seven seas. Atlas Obscura says for centuries, the stories of an enormous black ship, seen only in the flashes of lightning and traveling at unnatural speed despite tattered sails, have been passed down by many sailors. Many claim to have seen the legendary Flying Dutchman with their own eyes, telling tales of near misses and lucky turns of fate, which spared them the watery fate of most who saw but did not live to tell. Wherever the Flying Dutchman sails, the weather is said to change for the worse, another sign of its omen as a bringer of storms and catastrophe. So, the Hellhound, or as it was known in the folklore of Northern England, the Barghest, it is a kind of goblin dog with giant teeth and claws that only appears in the nighttime. Mm. It's believed that those who saw one clearly would die soon after, while those who caught only a glimpse of the beast would live on, but only for some months. There's also a similar dog creature from Wales that appears as a frightful apparition of a mastiff with menacing breath and blazing red eyes. It is referred to as the Dog of Darkness, or the Black Hound of Destiny. The apparitions like to haunt lonely roads at night. So there are reports of a black bird of Chernobyl that started appearing months before the disaster in 1986, The creature shared similar characteristics to Mothman. It was human-shaped, had wings, and glowing red eyes.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Just sounds like Mothman.
Exactly. News.com.au ran an article in June of 2019 about the creature. In it, they state those who came across the bird got mysterious phone calls and suffered terrible nightmares. These sightings actually happened every day until the morning of April 26 when the reactor blew. Rescue workers and pilots who battled the flames and rescued residents of the nearby town reported sights of a huge black figure flying from the destroyed reactor and circling the black smoke rising from it. So yeah, it's quite a bit like the Mothman. For the last harbinger of doom, and to me, the creepiest, because it is something that anybody can experience, it is the three knocks of doom.
Mm.
It is said that if you hear the three knocks, it means that you or someone you know is in immediate danger. The fear of the number three seems to stem from how three is seen as a demonic presence that is mocking the Holy Trinity. which I learned about in The Conjuring.
Yeah.
Liveabout.com covered this harbinger and even gathered stories from people who seem to have heard it. Here is one of the stories. One cold and very snowy evening, we are all gathered in the living room when suddenly we heard a very loud pounding on the front entry door. The door was sealed with weather stripping in the winter, and we never opened it after that, and the door was not lit at night. The pounding was very loud and insistent, so my mother went to our side entry door and called out to whoever was knocking to walk over to the side door. She called again, and there was no answer. She turned on the outside light over the front door and peered out the window, with the intent of motioning the visitor over to the side door for entry. There was no one there, and there was no footprints in the freshly fallen snow. My mom turned to us and said, "This means that there will soon be a death in the family." My dad, being a skeptic, suggested the noise was the wind blowing something against the door. The next morning, we got a call that our Uncle Charlie had passed away unexpectedly.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Freaky.
Well, that one just scared me because there was the snow and there was no footprints.
Oh, yeah.
That just terrified me.
So I actually have a little scary story about three knocks.
Really?
Because I used to live in an apartment by myself, and I would always have these really creepy nightmares in the bedroom. So much so that I slept in the living room.
What?
I had creepy nightmares and so many lucid dreams. Ooh. I would walk around the apartment in my dreams there.
What?
It was so strange. But it was my first apartment, and like I said, I was sleeping out in the living room. I was walking up from the couch to go get a book off my shelf, which was right next to the door of my room, which I always had closed because, like I said, the room just creeped me out. And I was bent over right by the door, and on the other side of the door, just three knocks. And I just went and sat on the couch. I was terrified. I did not open the door.
That's horrible.
I was very creeped out.
If you know of any other harbinger of doom that we didn't cover, let us know. Send us an email.
Earlier this month, the newspaper The Mirror wrote about a creepy forgotten island in Kent, England. The island is known as Dead Man's Island and Coffin's Bay. Over 200 years ago, this island was used as a burial ground for convicts who died while aboard prisoner ships. As water levels have changed over time, the bodies in the unmarked graves have been uncovered. Due to coastal erosion and a shift in tides, the remains of skulls, bone fragments, and coffins now stick out of the ground from the 6 feet of mud that once blanketed the area. The island was once lost under the high seas and was most recently explored in 2017 by the BBC's Inside Out Southeast program. The TV crew are among some of the only visitors to have set foot in the island in recent times, as people are banned due to its bird breeding and nesting site. Natalie Graham, who presented the Inside Out program, claims she'll never be able to forget the terrifying sight she saw on Dead Man's Island. Speaking to The Sun, she said, "What I saw there will stay with me forever. This is a really strange sight. I would imagine there can't be anywhere on Earth like this." The show's director, Sam Supple, added, "It is like being on the set of a horror film. It looks so surreal. It's like an art department has designed it. There are open coffins and bones everywhere. Locals have previously warned travelers of hounds with glaring red eyes that ate the heads of buried bodies and described a skin-crawling atmosphere at an island solely occupied by the dead."
The home where the 19th century accused killer Lizzie Borden allegedly murdered her father and stepmother with a hatchet in 1892 is for sale as a bed and breakfast. Borden was accused and tried of the gruesome double murders after the bodies were discovered in the house on the morning of August 4, 1892, in Fall River, Massachusetts. Andrew Borden and Abby Borden both suffered fatal blows to the head and multiple body strikes, 11 for Andrew and 19 for Abby, which were delivered with a hatchet. Lizzie was known to have quarreled with her father and stepmother and was thought by many to be guilty, but there was no evidence directly connecting her to the crime, and she was eventually acquitted. The case remains unsolved to this day. Today, the infamous home is open to the public as the Lizzie Borden Bed and Breakfast and Museum, equipped with furnishings, decor, and memorabilia that recall the grim and lurid events of more than a century ago. The current owner is ready to retire and is offering the home for $2 million, according to a listing posted by the Siboth team, a Massachusetts real estate agency. One interesting and unusual feature of the house is there are no hallways, except for the landing on the second floor. One had to go through one room to get to another, the Lizzie Borden Museum website says. That was one of the details that led many at the time to suspect that Lizzie was the murderer. Andrew was killed about an hour and a half after Abby, and a stranger in the house would have had few options for staying hidden. A weekend getaway to the site where one of the most notorious unsolved murders took place may not sound fun for everyone, but the real estate listing encourages prospective buyers to imagine taking a lighthearted approach to running this unique bed and breakfast, and even says in the listing, picture yourself serving fun hatchet cookies.
For our next spooky movie review, we head to the year 1980 with Fade to Black. Written and directed by Vernon Zimmerman, and starring Dennis Christopher as the lonely film buff who eventually goes on a killing spree resembling characters from his favorite movies. Dennis Christopher is also known, at least to me, as the adult version of Eddie Kazbrak in the 1990 made-for-TV two-part miniseries version of Stephen King's It. Dennis Christopher plays Eric Binford, a shy movie buff who delivers film supplies in L.A., Eric lives for film and uses them to escape his lonely reality. Eventually, his fantasies overtake him, and he begins murdering those who have betrayed him, all patterned after characters and incidents in his favorite films. The score was composed by Greg Safon, known for his work on Cheers, The Last Starfighter, and he even did some episodes of the 1980s Twilight Zone. This was in the time of simple but eerie synth and MIDI keyboard type scores, rather than orchestral ones. So, sounds kind of like this. Kind of like this. So, Amalia, what did you think of Dennis Christopher as Eric Binford, the crazed movie buff?
He creeped me out.
I love his impersonations.
Yeah.
Of all these movie characters.
The cowboy one was the one that really got me. That one I was like, I do not like this.
Because of the mask, probably.
Yeah, the mask, yeah.
In the movie, he really prides himself on movie trivia.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There's three movie posters behind his boss. One we definitely recognized.
Tourist Trap.
What was the middle one that the mummy eventually punches through? Gotcha. John Carpenter's Halloween.
Oh.
The original. And then to the very left, this was a movie I had not yet seen. Maybe we'll have to watch it and it might be the next one.
Okay.
End of the World. 1977, starring Christopher Lee, who is the Dracula character that he fashions himself after one of his murder sprees. So I loved Dennis Christopher as Eric Benford. I thought he did really good.
Yeah, he did.
He was just fun to watch. I think a lot of the other characters were not very good at acting.
I think they spent a lot of time writing his character and not so much character development on the supporting cast.
So there was also someone who became very big later that you didn't even recognize.
Well, first time I saw him in a movie was in like 2003.
Yeah, so. And he's had quite a bit of surgery.
Yes.
Who was it?
Mickey Rourke.
Yes, Mickey Rourke.
And it was his second movie.
It was the second movie. He plays a jerkwad.
He's a bully.
So there's also an underlying theme that I don't really find myself agreeing with, but it was there. The idea that violent TV has an effect on people and that they end up imitating the violence.
It was a little ahead of its time.
Dr. Jerry Moriarty, the kind of like psychiatrist guy that says, Benford is not crazy. He's a victim of his society. Believe me.
Yeah.
And also during the intimate scene with the female officer, he somehow has an entire box of Ritz crackers. Remember, they pull the blanket down and he just has Ritz crackers ready.
Yeah, ready to go.
And she doesn't say anything. She just reaches her hand in the box and gets some crackers too.
Yeah. So like many other horror movies, Fade to Black features footage from Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah, because it was in the public domain, right?
George A. Romero famously forgot to put the copyright symbol on the print. So the movie is public domain.
It's in so many things.
And free for anyone to use footage of.
That explains.
Well, use footage from.
Yeah, that explains a lot.
And Fade to Black was the first horror film to ever shoot in the Chinese theater in Hollywood.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of, footage from movies.
Yeah.
Kind of spliced into it that shows when he's having these certain reactions in his everyday encounters, where the inspiration for him acting that way comes from. I thought that was really interesting.
Did the neighborhood look familiar to you?
No.
It was shot around the Venice neighborhood of Los Angeles, the same area where A Nightmare on Elm Street, Heat, and Donnie Darko were filmed.
Hmm.
What did you think of the actress who played Marilyn?
Marilyn Monroe?
Marilyn O'Connor.
Ah, but to him, she was Marilyn Monroe.
Yes.
He always, and she, that was her whole gig too.
Yeah.
Right? She was like a Marilyn Monroe lookalike. So this is a great film for film buffs.
Yeah.
Of course, because it just has so many great movie references and it's just kind of fun. But out of our rating system, good, good, so bad it's good, or bad, bad, what you think?
I wasn't a huge fan of it, to be honest. So maybe just bad for me.
And me, on the total other side of the spectrum, I think it's kind of just good.
Well, Roger Ebert would have agreed with you because he praised the movie.
It's not like super gory, which was his whole thing.
Mm-hmm. He gave it 3 out of 4 stars.
Yeah, Roger Ebert did not like gory movies.
No, he didn't.
Every time there was any gore.
But he liked thrillers.
He would flip out.
And he called this an intriguing thriller.
Yeah. Bad, bad for Amalia. Good, good for John. So if you even those out, it was so bad, it's good. And also so good, it's bad. It really shows our taste differences. So that was our second movie review.
You and Lily both 2 paws up.
Thanks again for tuning in to another episode of Anomalous Waves.
Don't forget to check our show notes for all of our references, our contact information, and our social media.
If you have any spooky stories you want to share or ideas for future episodes, please email them to anomalouswaves@gmail.com or message us on any of our social media. All right, thanks. Bye.
Goon Lashish.